Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's October 26, 2012. You're listening to the best PokerCast in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Saskatchewan Scott Long.
I can't believe you still remember that.
That's the last time I'm going to do it.
Charleston Chew?
Chattanooga Chris.
Chattanooga, okay. I don't remember what I was.
Well, Harry had name badges made up for us, man.
Oh, my God.
It was exciting.
I thought it was Charleston Chris.
Nah, Chattanooga.
Charleston's
nowhere near as funny as Chattanooga.
Yeah, okay.
And I mean, the nickname. I mean, I don't want our listeners
to... Oh, jeez. Don't worry about it.
Throwing rocks at me and stuff.
I don't think we have any fans
we're done
in either
with that.
One of those places.
I thought it was kind of fun to remember for one more. Well, what else is fun that we're working on now? We got this great email from one of our listeners, Dan Banks, and he wants us to do a show on the best poker quotes, fictional or real. And some of the ideas he threw at us was, of course, well, Worm from Rounders, in the game of life, women are the rake.
Best line ever.
Well, see, now we're done.
Yeah, we're
Thanks
done.
Thanks for setting the bar so high there, Cassandra.
Well, we didn't say try to find the number one quote. We said the best poker quotes. To me, that's
now,
the best
now,
one.
Now the rest are all just going to be disappointing.
To me, at least.
You want to say from Deadwood, you know, Wild Bill Hickok, who's asking a man in the bar, do you want to play poker? And the guy responds, I was never good at it. And Wild Bill says, you let that stop you? And then, of course, something like Phil Hellmuth is, I guess if there were no luck involved, I would win every hand.
What's your favorite one? Do you have one that comes to mind, at least?
I do, this is how twisted I am. I mean, our listeners probably know I'm a big presidential history buff, right? So what's hilarious to me is I'm a poker publisher for the last 4 years, host a poker show for the last 7, and when somebody asks me my favorite poker quote, I immediately go to a president rather than Johnny Chan or somebody.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
But I immediately thought of the buck stops here.
Yeah, me too. That's funny. I was doing a search on it today. Isn't that weird? I did a search on that to say that that's the one I was going to mention because I wanted to see if it was legitimately true that he liked to play cards and that he did take the button and say that and stuff. But it's true. That's exactly what I was thinking of, too. That's so weird.
I believe he was playing a card game when he found out that Roosevelt died.
Yeah, that's so weird. Wow.
People probably don't know that's a poker reference, either, though.
Yeah, I know. They always think it just means that, you know, pass the buck means they're passing ownership of something, but... really, he coined it that way. So that's kind of cool. So don't forget, email your favorite quotes to podcast@anteupmagazine.com. Even post them on our forum at anteupmagazine.com/forum or on Scott's pathetic Facebook page. And we'll use the best ones on a future show, maybe even in the magazine.
I'll tell you, I put the post up, so look for that on the forum, and I also started the thread on Facebook as well, too. The very first response...
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure we'll work this on the show whenever we do it again. Andy Duke has been eliminated.
Oh, man.
That's how twisted our Facebook fans are. So. but yeah, definitely send that to us, and hopefully we'll do a show here in a couple weeks, and then obviously put in the magazine. So we love our reader interactions, don't we?
Absolutely. And, you know, without them, things like, coming out with our 50th issue...
Wow,
couldn't be possible.
When did that happen?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When we hit 48, it was cool because I was looking at the archives and I'm thinking 4 years, 12, you know, 12 issues, yeah. 48. And then, you know, we came out with the 50th issue and we've already done the 51st issue. That's how long it took us to realize we did 50. Yeah, we're pretty excited. We've done 51 issues of Ante Up magazine. Everything's relative. You know, if you did a weekly magazine, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. You'd be coming up on your one-year anniversary. But when you do it monthly... It's saying something. We're in our fifth year of publishing now. It's pretty crazy.
Well, yeah, in the show notes I put it's one of these cheesy, doesn't really mean anything tangibly milestones.
Yeah.
Which is completely true. I mean, what was a big deal about 50 versus D1, right? So it doesn't really matter or anything. But, you know, when I realized it, I realized it when I was uploading the covers to our Facebook page. And, you know, I now have 50 covers in the gallery. So I'm like, hey. But to me, it was, I remember when we started the magazine, and I don't want to say there are haters, but there are a lot of skeptics.
Yeah.
You know, when we told friends and family and coworkers what we were doing. And, you know, everybody wished us well, obviously, but you could tell the ones that were like, these guys have no shot.
Yeah.
They're going to come back here begging for their job in about 3 months. And I remember one person that actually had started a magazine before told me, you know, hey, that first issue is great. It's the third issue that's hard.
Yeah.
If you get 3 issues done, then you come back and talk to me. Well, hey, we're at 51 now, toots.
Toots. Toots.
That'll teach you to believe in me. But no, I mean, that's just what I think back. And the fact that, I mean, again, we're not going to wax on too long here. We got a real show to do. But I'm still in this fog of, I can't believe it's been 4 years or 7 years or whatever milestone you want to use. I mean, it still seems like we're just getting started with this.
Yeah, that's true. It's remarkable how fast things go by. You know, it's funny, you put the magazine to bed, meaning we sent it to the press, and I'm like, oh, phew, I got a couple of minutes to breathe, you know? And then it's like, I'm sending out a message to all of our writers, deadlines tomorrow, or so, you know? It's like, it just never stops, and that's how the time flies, you know? It's just remarkable. You think, oh, they got a whole month to put out that magazine. Well, it's not really like that, you know? You really have a couple of weeks to really do it, and then you work on the next one, and it's just crazy how fast things go by, you know? And it's because we do so much, too, between...
Yeah.
The show, the cruises, the website, the radio appearances, the traveling, now the tour, and of course the magazine. It's just one thing leads after another. You think you're done with one thing, and you got something else coming up. It just never stops. But very thankful to, you know, especially our listeners, because without a lot of our listeners, we wouldn't have a magazine either. You know, they
very true.
A lot of them helped us come up with the idea of how we would do the magazine and stuff. So it's really a great thing. And we're really, really proud to be doing what we're doing, and we're glad that you guys are still there with us.
Thanks, everyone.
You know, speaking of missed milestones, we passed 2,112 Twitter followers a little while ago, and I totally didn't say anything about it.
Boy, we must have had a rush to have them at the end.
We're actually quickly approaching 2,200 now, so... Keep pushing at Annie Up Magazine, baby. Keep pushing. But yeah, everyone's like, 2112 was his real goal, and when it got there, I didn't say anything. I was like, oh, I forgot to say something on the show. Now it's come and gone.
All right, well, we got a hotline call all the way from the Green of Ireland. Is it really green there?
I think it is.
One of these things ugly Americans think of.
No, right. I think it is green there.
It's really green, right?
Yeah, my brother went there and came back with photos. They're all green.
They're all green. Yeah. Excellent. Very good. All right. Well, Diane from Ireland called us up at 813-448-1120. And we always like that when the international folks call, because we know that cost them a pretty dime or euro or whatever it is, right? But she sent this in, or called quite a while ago, so we apologize, Dan. We're just catching up. But she read an interesting story that Nolan Dahl, the... Series of Poker posted about Florida, and she wanted her thoughts, so let's listen to her clip.
Hiya, this is Diana calling from Ireland. I just was reading Nolan Dalla's report on the Palm Beach Kennel Club and the circuit event. He wrote it at the beginning of August, and it talks about Florida poker and Florida in general and the Palm Beach Kennel Club, and I wondered if you both had read it and what you thought about it in general. Okay, and I hate that your machine has no beep to say begin speaking, but I love you guys. Bye.
Not to get off tangent here, but my favorite part about this call was the phone number that printed up when it came out as a hotline clip. Because usually when somebody calls us, it gives us their phone number as to who it came from. This one was 000-012-3456. That's how you know it's an international call, because it's not a real number. Interesting reading. I didn't realize that Nolan Dalla could be so salty, by the way.
Yeah, I think I was reading Untraceable there.
still available at Amazon.com. Chris Cassandra's first novel, Untraceable. Low, low, low price of $2.99.
You know, but speaking of that, what I thought was funny is, you know, when I started reading it, I had a flashback about a year and a half ago when I sat down with him at the Palm Beach Kennel Club and interviewed him for the show.
Yeah.
And he mentioned during that, because we were talking about federal regulation, and he's like, you know, my friends, people know me well, know I am extremely opinionated, so there's no secret about that. And I'm like, okay, great. I had no idea how accurate he was being.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know he had his own blog, and he lets it fly there. There's no sugarcoating on anything. But as far as what I read yesterday, very little poker. I mean, a lot of it's just his life in general, but very interesting reads. But yeah, he doesn't hold back, does he?
No, and it just shocked me considering the position that he holds now and the places that he goes to. And he's talking about very negatively about the places that he's going to sometimes. And it's like, hello, you're supposed to be representing us. But I mean, he obviously just, a lot of it's tongue-in-cheek, and a lot of it's just, you know, stuff that's out of the place's control. So he's right. Just speaking his mind. But yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I've talked to him at least 24 times over the years. And, you know, he makes a joke here and there or whatever, but I've never heard him use that kind of language. I was just shocked when I was reading it.
Professional, probably. He's when he's on the clock, he's probably a little different. I mean, it's like us, you know, we let a small transgression fly every once in a while on the show, and we giggle about it. But yeah, you come to our home game, and it's, you know,
it's
sailors don't even come to our home game.
Yeah.
But anyhow, his blog is at nolandala.com, and what Diane was referencing was a post from, I believe, August 1st or August 2nd. He kind of did a little vacation down here. Actually, very interesting stuff about staying with Dewey Tomko. I don't know if you actually got to read that post.
Yeah, I peeked a little bit about that and the expensive homes and everything. Yeah.
But what she was specifically mentioning is Noah was talking about the players at Palm Beach Kennel Club and how most of them appear to be transplanted New Yorkers or New Jersey folks, which is true. And he, you know, he says they're, I'm paraphrasing here, but they're kind of rude know-it-alls, very loud. They think they know it all, and he says they don't. And so that makes for some pretty soft games, and probably really soft games down here, and also lots of conversation at the table. And so, I mean, I guess what I'll say, I'll, obviously very interesting what you have to say, is the first thing that I took from it is that we have a caller from Ireland asking us what we think about this, and I just kind of wanted to make it clear that Florida's a big state.
Yeah.
It's huge. I mean, you can drive from Pensacola to Chicago quicker than you can drive from Pensacola to Miami. That's how big our state is.
That's so crazy.
And really, at best, it's three states in one, I think. You know, you got that northern part of the state, the panhandle, that's really kind of southern in nature. Then you got kind of this Tampa Bay area, the central part of the state that's, in my opinion, kind of more Midwestern-y. And then you got South Florida, which is either very heavy Latin influence or a lot of these New York, New Jersey transplants, as he's mentioning down there, and a real interesting melting pot. So I guess what I would say is, you know, I certainly wouldn't take Nolan's comments as indicative of Florida poker as a whole.
Hmm.
It's indicative of poker in really specifically Palm Beach County, but maybe even the Fort Lauderdale area as well, too. But I don't think what he described I see on a regular basis anywhere else in the state.
When I moved here 17 years ago, it's funny, when I came to the Tampa Bay area, there were some people who lived here already, and they're like, are you sure you want to be on this coast? And I was like, what do you mean? They said, they're like, all New Yorkers and New Jersey guys live on the east coast of Florida, and then we get all the Michigan, Ohio guys on this side. Yep. And I was like, no, I want to live over here. And they're like, okay, well, you know, we're all polite over here. You know, I mean, that was basically what they said to me when I first got here. And
I love it. That's perfect.
It is true that a lot of New York, I mean, when it's funny, when I first moved here, every license plate that wasn't Florida was a Michigan plate. And that, not so much with the recession or with things going, you know, down a little bit, the economy lately. But and then you hardly ever saw New York plates. But when I was over visiting my brother-in-law in West Palm, I'd see New York plates all the time. So it's true. It probably is. Yeah. You know, without being too cliche or stereotypical, Scott's pretty much hit it on the head. That's pretty much what it's like here. So the state is massive. Think about it. There's 30 poker rooms in one state that's not in Las Vegas. You know what I mean? It's pretty massive. So, but I I mean, I think he also appreciated the fact that there was conversation at the table and that there were people he was playing against, and not the, as he called them, robots of Las Vegas who, you know, put their iPods on and try to take every dime that you have and don't talk to you while you're sitting there. So, you know, if you like a conversational game, you're going to get that here easily, no matter where you play in Florida, probably.
Yeah, that's probably true. I would say if you're going to extrapolate anything statewide, it would be that I think our games are friendlier here than anywhere other than maybe Mississippi, I think, are definitely.
Yeah, Mississippi's really good, too. But
aside from that, yeah, I'd probably say Florida games are the most friendliest, or not friendliest is probably the wrong word, but most conversational.
Yeah.
Anywhere I've played. So, but, you know, the actual... And, you know, I think we've always said this before, too, on the show, that the games here are soft compared to other places. Mm-hmm. And my theory has always been that here in the state, outside of the Seminole properties and a couple of these little day cruises, we don't have casino gaming down here.
Right.
And even the Seminoles, it's not full casino gaming. So, you know, you have blackjack players or craps players or roulette players playing poker because that's the only thing they can play to get their gaming fix.
Right, and they're not really interested in getting better. They're interested in, like, making big hands or winning big pots, so they're not really the best players.
Yeah, or they're just, you know, it's not their game of choice, so they're not going to spend a lot of time listening to the Annie PokerCast or reading books or anything, whereas if they live in Vegas and you're a blackjack player, well, you know, you're going to play poker once in a while just for a change of pace, but you're going to play blackjack, right?
So, right.
And so I think that's what helps make the games a little softer down here, but... But definitely, I definitely recommend folks go to NolanDalla.com and read a little bit. I think it's a fascinating reading. And next time I see him, I'm going to ask him when he sleeps.
Exactly.
You know, because I started this travel blog at the beginning of the year, and I was doing like little like four paragraph posts, right?
Yeah.
And I couldn't keep that up for more than a month with my schedule. And I know he's busier than I am, and his posts are like War and Peace.
I know.
Go on and on and on.
I know.
And he does great recaps of the World Series, which he writes every night. So, I mean, this is a guy that just, you take away his computer, and I don't know what he does. I'm sure he's driving down the street and typing something, you know.
And you have to remember, too, and he co-authored that one-of-a-kind Stu Unger story, too. So, I think he co-authored it, right? I don't know if he wrote it all himself.
Yeah, he probably had a couple 5 minutes every day that he didn't know what to write about. So let's just bang out a book.
You know? Bang a book, too. What the hell?
All right, Diane, we appreciate you calling the hotline all the way from the green, green, green grass of Ireland. And we're going to be happy to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store. And remember to call 813-448-1120. And you too might win a fabulous prize.
Apparently, Johnny Cash is writing into the show now.
It says, "Oh, I thought it was Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones."
Man in Black. So it says I'm going to read it, Scott, because you're a limit player more than I am. So, after being out of work for the past 18 months, I have recently found a new job. However, I am making about 70% of my normal salary, so I was thinking about trying to supplement my income with some poker. I live in Las Vegas, so I have every game available to me. I think no limit is out of my bankroll and way too swingy. I'm trying to find maybe $500 a month to get caught up with my bills. What's the lowest limit hold'em level where a recreational player can make a decent secondary income in regards to the rake, jackpot, and high hand drops, etc.?
All right, well, I'll say I think you have to eliminate 2, 4, 3, 6 right away.
Yeah.
Now, we talked about this before. I mean, any game is beatable if you're playing against bad players and you're playing well. So it doesn't matter what the rake is. You could still beat it. But generally speaking, 2, 4, 3, 6, if you're trying to make X amount a month, it's not going to happen at those.
Right.
I think it's probably also going to be very difficult even at the 4-8 level, but you probably have a shot, an outside shot at it. I would say to start, before you could actually start being profitable at limit, you're going to have to be a 6-12 player higher, I think.
Wow. I wasn't expecting that.
And that's probably going to be tough for somebody that's obviously been out of work for 18 months and making 70% of what he is and trying to scrape another 500. And you could probably make 500 at 4-8. I mean, I would certainly start there, I guess, but I would temper my expectations, I think.
It also depends how often he's going to play. We don't know that part of the equation,
true.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if he's playing one shift, he's going to have to play 2040. Yeah, I mean, we don't know.
Yeah, but his question was more in regards to the rake and jackpot drop in right hand, which, you know, I think is smart because you got to factor that in, that knowing that, you know, I was talking to another poker operator this week, and they had just started a new bring your home game mm-hmm. to the room, and they give you a pitcher of beer and a pizza, and I had to remind them of our great Antioch meetup at the Commerce, to go where we got free appetizers. Appetizers for everyone! And at the end of the night, none of us had any money left. and, you know, it's because of the rake. I think he's on the right path for at least understanding that. But
hey, is there like I said, I don't play limit, but is there a level where they don't do the high hand and stuff? You know, I know in a lot of the no-limit games they do.
You might certainly not 4-8 or lower. So definitely you need to get in 6-12. I would imagine like a 10-20, 20-40, 15-30, those kind of games probably don't take it. And at that point, I mean, you got so much more money on the table.
Yeah, it doesn't even matter.
I mean, you're going to go a time charge and you get that high, so it's a little bit different, but certainly much easier to make a living at those levels if you're talented enough to make a, you know.
I was going to guess
4-8.
I was going to guess 4-8 just because I've watched you play 4-8 and I've seen you make, you know, on any given night a couple of $100. And it's like, if you're doing that on one shift and if you're a quality 4-8 player, you're going to make some money. So at 3-6, I always thought it was tough to beat that overall. I mean, I think I've sat down at 3-6 and beaten it. I think we've played horse, or when we have our meetups, we always play 3-6 and we generally walk away winners from those games, but not enough to. You have to do it every single time you sat down, and you've got to make, you know, for some bad sessions as well. But I think 4-8 might be the first level where you might be able to pull it off.
Yeah, I'd certainly try it. Yeah. And obviously, I'd be looking for a room that doesn't take a jackpot drop as well, too, which, you know, in Vegas, I think, I don't believe Venetian does.
They think they just started to. I don't know what game they do, but that was their newest thing with the Sands Poker Room. They started jackpots, so I don't know what level it's at, but they
think
do
maybe
have.
What Bellagio maybe and Aria probably don't.
Yeah, they don't.
One of those, but yeah, I mean, I would look for a room like that, and you know, then you're talking $4 or $5 in rake per hand, and yeah, give it a shot.
Interesting.
All right. In the meantime, we are going to send you a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells the latest shirts for gals and guys in the Antioch store at antiochstore.com, and they have plenty of options in black. So you should be happy, man in black. Thanks for sending that to us. And remember, everyone else, email your mailbag questions to podcast@antiochmagazine.com, and you too might be a winner.
Our call to floor this week comes from our good friend and longtime listener, AZ Slick. Haven't heard from him in a while.
No.
Says, I wrote an email to an online poker site about the way their software manages a dead button. If the big blind and small blind both go out on the same hand, the button moves to the next available player, which has not had either blind. I got an email back saying that there are many brick-and-mortar rooms that do it this way. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Now, here's what Jody says. He says, no-limit cash games, it isn't unheard of to move the button every hand to make the blinds correct, regardless of who paid what on the previous hand. This isn't allowed in tournaments under the TDA rules, though.
Yeah, I've never agreed with that you can actually escape paying it, or paying, you have to pay it quicker. I mean, there was something, I remember that too, and I don't know which online site it was, because I only played in a few, but I don't want to point out the wrong one in case of, you know, I'm wrong, but there was at least one site where it was like, all right, wait a minute, this guy could have at least paid the big blind here or the small blind here or something, and it jumped over him and he got the button somehow, and it was weird. It was really weird, and I didn't appreciate it. I was like, why isn't this guy having to pay the full price that I had to pay this round? It just annoys me. That's the kind of stuff that would piss a lot of people off, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe we should press Jody a little bit more for you know, a discussion of why some rooms do it differently. But yeah, it does seem like everybody should pay regardless and keep that button frozen. But I know some rooms don't like to freeze the button. They like the button to move every hand. And sometimes they get into that complicated thing where you've got, you know, two small blinds and one big blind, you know, usually when somebody skips their small blind or something. And that gets really confusing as well, too. I mean, a good dealer can manage it. But there seems like there has to be a better way. And, you know, just keeping the button there until everybody's paid properly.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. All right, so if the small blind, the big blind go out, obviously the next person would have to play a big, there wouldn't be a small, right? And then the next hand, he would play the small, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem that hard, right?
Oh. But the online site moves the button to the guy who hadn't even paid anything yet. Now he gets to not pay it at all.
Well, maybe it's like landing on free parking.
Oh, jeez. Well, there's a reason why it's not allowed in TDA rules. Because it's ridiculous. So.
And that's a very good point, too. I mean, obviously, we have some disagreements with the TDA rules, and I know other people do, too. But, you know, I mean, some rules, obviously, are tournament-specific. But this is one that doesn't, you know, if it's not allowed in tournaments, why is it allowed in cash?
Yeah. Doesn't make sense. Yeah, it's weird.
All right, well, AZ Slick, we're going to let you control the button in the future, because we're going to send you a classic tournament dealer button from tournamentbutton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo, and ask about the Andy Up logo version, and definitely use code Andy Up for free shipping. And Slick, you can move it whenever the heck you want to.
Man, brilliant marketing.
Not bad.
Yeah, you're a genius. Well, we wanted to announce this last week, but we had a couple of little tie-ups, but now we're very excited to say that the Red Rock Casino Resort Spa in Las Vegas will be hosting an Annie Up Poker Tour event January 21st to the 27th. More details will be announced soon, but Scott is expected to be on site for the entire event.
I love Vegas in January.
Sure, that's a perfect time to go. It's chilly you know,
actually,
plus,
I prefer the summer.
But yeah, but
mostly because I prefer the summer because I to watch you being miserable.
Yeah.
And I got cheated out of that last year because I was more miserable because I had no baggage.
Yeah, well, that was sort of like landing on free parking for me.
So now I'm going to go out in January. I'm not going to be able to swim because it's going to be like 36 degrees.
I think they have a heated pool for you.
Yeah, maybe.
But don't forget, too, our inaugural AUPT event is at Thunder Valley Casino Resort in Sacramento, California, November 19th to December 3rd. And again, Scott will be on site November 23rd to 26th. Of course, you can get all the details about all of our events on AnnieUpPokerTour.com. Very exciting stuff. Another stop for us. We've got some momentum, buddy.
Yeah, definitely excited about Vegas. And Red Rock's such a gorgeous place.
Yes.
I mean, it's one of those kind of hidden gems, I think, out there just because it's not on the strip. People don't make it out to as much as they should, but absolutely gorgeous. So looking forward to hanging out there. And I'm starting to get calls and emails from folks saying, hey, I'll see you at Thunder Valley, Scott. So I think that's going to be a huge event.
Absolutely. So,
definitely hope to see some people show up for that one as well, too. And then, of course, I'm going to be at Dover Downs Hotel and Casino in Delaware at 7 p.m. on Friday, November 9th. That's the night before we set sail on the Annie Up Poker Cruise out of Baltimore. And we'll be playing in that $100 buy-in, $10,000 guaranteed tournament that night. I'm going to pack a little pair of those Blue Shark optics for whoever knocks me out. And of course, you don't have to be on the cruise to come out and play, have some fun, just show up and say hi. And I believe our Mid-Atlantic ambassador Mike Young told me he'll be out there as well. And of course the lovely Mrs. Long will be as well too. So lots of us, come out and say hi.
Wow, it's like a fantasy trip. Bring your autograph book, everybody. Well, speaking of Dover Downs, Crown Royal Poker Room there, and of course the Silks Poker Room at Tampa Bay Downs, they're each hosting the inaugural Annie Up Poker League for each one of their rooms, and they're having some Poker Cruise giveaways with it too. So visit AnnieUpMagazine.com/leagues for all the details.
And it is our last call for the November 10th Baltimore Cruise featuring Lee Childs and Jonathan Little. Our guest later on in the show today will be the pro on our February 4th cruise out of Port Canaveral. Those rates are start at $369, are only guaranteed through November 19th, so you get about less than a month to lock in that great rate. And then don't forget, we're also sailing out of Miami, New York City, and Tampa next year. So get all the details on our cruises, including how you can win your way on board at Dover Downs, Derby Lane, Tampa Bay Downs, Daytona Beach Kendall Club, and soon a couple other spots with at AntiUpCruises.com. That's AntiUpCruises.com. Visit AntiUpCruises.com.
You're starting to sound like one of those infomercials on TV. The guy says it like 100 times
in
a row.
I've been saying it up late.
All right, let's see what happened around the country in our Antiup news desk.
South Point Poker expected to launch this month as the first licensed and regulated online poker site in the United States. Has said it will delay its launch as late as December as it continues to work through the independent lab test process. Meanwhile, Boyd Gaming, Golden Nugget, and Station Casinos have all received licenses as well.
Wow.
So pretty much we're the only people that don't have a license.
Yeah, we're going to have to apply for one, I think.
Yeah.
We'll have to get a residency in like Carson City or something. I don't know, somewhere over there.
Carson City. All the great places in Nevada live. You pick Carson City.
Okay, Greg Raymer, who was on the cover of our November issue of NEUP Magazine after winning his second Heartland Poker Tour event of the year, became the first player in HPT history to win three titles in a season when he won at Prairie Meadows in Iowa. Pretty cool stuff. I even messaged him just now on Skype and said congrats and told him he's going to be on the cover, and he hasn't said anything to me yet.
Well, he's probably busy with lots of others. He's probably busy winning another Heartland right now.
Yeah, he's probably winning another one, so, but I'm sure he'll get back to me.
But you know, I talked about this on Fifth Street Radio last night, and that some players are just comfortable in certain environments. And obviously, I mean, Greg Raymer won the World Series, so I'm not necessarily saying that he's just a pro at Heartland Poker Tour. But obviously, being the quality player he is, and then you factor in that you know exactly how the structure is going to work at each of these events, I think that gives you a big advantage.
Oh, absolutely.
I think there's a couple of Heartland players that are considered or continually a threat in there, including Craig Cassino.
Yep.
Was also at this final table. He's done very well. So I think there's something to be said about, you know, focusing on a particular something that's consistent and really getting good at it. I mean, it's almost like being a no limit hold'em specialist, I guess.
Yeah, once you know what to expect and you know how to succeed at it, it's amazing how you can always succeed at it. It's kind of like just learning how to do something for the first time and then you get really good at it. Sort of like when I was playing Guitar Hero.
Yeah.
When I first started, I was terrible at it. But then once I figured it out, I was really good at it. So
not hopefully... me. I got web fingers. Have you ever seen my web fingers?
I don't look at you very often when we're together.
No, but I mean, I can't move any of my fingers without all my fingers moving. It makes it incredibly difficult to play Guitar Hero. Unless I play the one button version, but you're not going to win any Guitar Hero.
It explains a lot of your typing problems, too.
That's probably true as well, yes. All right, and finally, a county sheriff in Oklahoma says he's returning more than $2,000 in campaign contributions from a donor who's been charged in an 81-count indictment alleging that he ran an illegal poker games and took sports bets in his home.
Huh.
Yeah, that's probably not good for a sheriff to be taking money from somebody like that.
No.
Now, of course, he said, obviously, he didn't know this was going on, and so we're giving the benefit of the doubt. But
81-count indictment, my God.
Well, you know, they just throw in a couple. It's like when you buy a car, you know. You get all the super sport package, and then you get they throw in the mats and the mud flaps, and, you know, a bunch of stuff that you don't need. So I'm sure there's a couple counts in there that are BS, right?
Yeah, I have to agree with that. That's a lot of counts. Hey, we get to wrap up on O'Malley's Move today. Very exciting stuff. Let's refresh our memory with part one right now.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no limit hold'em cash game. The action has been loose pre-flop, but timid, and then explodes after the flop. We bought in for 400 and now have 425. We're on the button and everybody limps to us. We have the king of spades, jack of spades. We limp. The small blind calls, the big blind checks, family pot, $18 in it, and the flop comes, jack of clubs, nine of clubs, deuce of hearts. The small blind checks, and the big blind bets $51 into the $18 pot. He's been overbetting all night and likes to play his draws fast. It gets folded around to us, and we go into the tank. He's probably just on some kind of draw. Ace-Jack doesn't scare us. He's raised with that pre-flop on more than one occasion. He also would have raised with jacks and nines, and there's no way he'd lead out at this for $51 if he flopped a set. It might be some kind of flush draw, or possibly queen 10. This is a gut check, but we're ready to take the sheriff's badge back from this outlaw. Not to mention, we've got him outchipped by about 100. We call, and he looks surprised that we did. The small blind folds. The pot is now at about 120, and we're hit with bittersweet feelings as the king of hearts peels off on the turn. If he had queen 10, we are dead to a king or a jack. but he checks. Well, you know me. Always erring on the side of caution, we check behind. And the river is the deuce of clubs. That's a heartbreaker. Not only does it complete the flush draw and trip up a random two, it's also a good card for our opponent to bluff on. Good thing we have position. Oh boy. He just shoved for 270. What do we do here?
Alright, I'm going to say it's kind of troubling that this player is so unpredictable. But that being said, I really have trouble putting him on any hand of consequence. And my gut says he senses our check on the turn as a weakness. And I think he's trying to bully us off this pot. So, you know, based on what O'Malley has told us about him, I can't put him on a hand that has his beat. So I'm calling.
I'm going to have to fold. If for no other reason, just disagree with you.
That's fine. Let me say.
But O'Malley puts him on a draw, and every draw got there. If he's holding queen 10 or clubs, you know, if he says he's on a draw and draws get there, I'm done with the hand, so I gotta let it go. Plus, he could have a deuce. He could have an ace deuce or something, which gives him three of a kind. It beats us too. So lots of hands beat us. I'm not going to risk my entire stack on this. I'm just going to move along. So
Why so much?
Hey, that could be part of our famous quotes show next week, so 2 weeks from now.
But that's what I always got to think. I mean, obviously, second or third level, then someone that has a big hand is going to bet a bunch because you're going to get some idiot like me that says, why so much? And call.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, and again, we're playing, what, a 1-2 no limit here? I can't put too many people on that kind of that kind of move. I got to think that it screams a bluff to me. So.
Yeah, just queen 10.
I could be wrong, but.
Queen 10's a roll.
What I think is funny is I'm the conservative one here.
I know,
right?
I know.
And almost everybody on the forum said fold in a minute, so. Yeah. Once again, I'm the black sheep of the PokerCast family.
Okay, let's see what happens.
Hello again. We have top two pair on an underpaired, straightening, and flushing board. Our two pair shrinks up pretty quickly. There are a number of combinations that have us beat. The one that makes the most sense is queen 10. He checked preflop, tried to push us off top pair when he was open-ended on the flop, checked the turn with the nuts, and then shoved on the river. This is very typical of this laggy. It fits his MO. However, how can he not even be a little worried we flushed out on the river? Can we call here? Nope. Even if he doesn't have queen 10, he could really have any combination of clubs. And I wouldn't put this guy past playing something random like ace deuce. We're gonna fold. The tough part is, we never get to see it. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, never try to become the table sheriff unless you've got the guts to come out firing. I hope to see you on the felt.
Alright, well, this is kind of the problem with whether we do hands of the week or O'Malley too is if you're not there, you don't get the full picture.
Yeah,
and I think he added in, painted around the edges here a little bit in part two that might have helped me make a different decision about this opponent. But knowing what I know now, maybe I would have second thoughts about calling. I think I probably still would, but at least I'm gonna think about it a little bit more. But from how it was described in part one, I'm still sticking with I think the fact that we made the wrong move here by folding. But the bottom line, this is why kids should not let kids play no limit. You know, you play for stacks every hand possibly.
Yeah.
And limit, I got to worry about making that last $8 call.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how far I've changed my opinion on no limit hold'em. I mean, it's not that I won't play it, and I still play it, especially if I and playing another game and go broke and I want to make my money back real quick, I go play no limit hold'em and basically just lose more. But sometimes I go back and try to win some money back. But I agree with you. I think it sucks that you're always put to a test with stuff like this. But I'm going to stand by my initial reaction, and I'm going to stay glad that I folded. Just because he didn't show doesn't mean he didn't have us. So a lot of hands beat us there, and I just felt like we were beat. And
yeah. Well, this is certainly one of those hands that's going to stick with you for a while, right?
Yeah.
When absolutely. You wish you were on TV and you just had to wait 4 or 5 months for post-production to find out what he had. But it's never going to happen. So the rest of your life, you're going to wake up with cold sweats going, no! He bluffed me!
Well, you know, I would much rather be bluffed and still have my stack than to call and lose all my stack and regret it for 6 months. So,
we should put that on a license plate. All right, Chris, today's guest is a fantastically talented poker professional with more than $5 million in career tournament winnings. That's about $5 million more than us.
At least.
He's got two World Poker Tour main event titles. He was the World Poker Tour Player of the Year for Season 6. He's also one of the most dedicated poker entrepreneurs on the circuit as well. He owns the trading site FloatTheTurn.com. He's an owner of 3Bet Clothing Line. He's a Blue Shark Optics Pro. He's an author of the best-selling Secrets of Professional Tournament Poker Books. And, of course, he's a senior strategy columnist for Anti-Up Magazine. And on February 4th, he'll be the onboard pro for the Anti-Up Cruise. And Jonathan Little joins us today to talk about all of this. Jonathan, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. Well, we want to touch on all the things you're involved with, but let's start with what we're most excited about, and that's that you're going to be sailing with us in February. And on board, you're going to be teaching a free intermediate strategy class for all of our passengers, but you're also going to be offering 4 more advanced classes for folks that that want to opt into those, and that's the most we've ever had on a cruise. Give us a preview of what our passengers can expect from your training.
Well, I mean, first off, I love going on cruises. I go on cruises at least once a year with my family, usually around Christmas time, because that's the easy way to get the family together. But so I'm actually going to be bringing my parents along for the cruise, so it's going to be a lot of fun, I'm sure. In the intermediate class, I'm going to go through a few things that I think can drastically improve the vast majority of everyone's game, and you know, both tournament and cash game poker. And I'm going to be giving out a few little like gifts to people that will that they can take with them to help along the way, so they can remember some of the stuff that I teach them. And I think that it's going to be really helpful for pretty much everyone. And as for the advanced classes, I'm going to come with a few different topics to each class. Some of the classes are going to be about cash games and some about tournaments. That way we can keep the ideas separate because they are sort of different games.
Right.
And I wanted to do as many classes as possible because I know that a lot of guys are on the boat to learn to play poker and to play poker. And I see no reason to have too much downtime. I mean, I'm there to work and to provide a good experience for everyone, so hopefully they come out.
That's right. Awesome. Well, you know, you do a lot of your training through your online site, FloatTheTurn.com. What's your approach to training on there, and what can our listeners expect if they become members?
Well, we have a lot of different approaches. Actually, you can go there and you can sign up and get a free month, so everyone can just go there and try it out for free.
Cool.
We have poker forums where people can ask whatever questions they have, and I get on there and answer them pretty regularly. That's one of the easiest ways to learn. That way, you know, you can actually ask me questions directly. The other way we do training videos. We have a lot of poker training videos. Some are where you watch myself or other professionals on my site play, like live sessions. Sometimes we review our hand histories after we played them, and sometimes we go over just specific concepts, like, you know, when to continuation bet or when to re-raise people pre-flop, stuff like that. So we do that, and then also each month we have what's called a webinar, where it's basically people get online and ask me questions in real time, and I answer them, and then I usually record those and put those back up on the site as well. So even if you missed the live webinar, you can get back on and watch it from the, you know, in the future. And also I'm having a lot of my other coaches start doing the webinars as well, because people love them. They get on for about an hour and a half, and they can ask us whatever they feel like. It's basically private coaching for $8 a month. So
wow, very cool.
Can't really beat
$8
it.
A month. Great. You know, plenty of poker pros think they can teach the game, but few actually can, I think. And your Anti-Up columns and your books are so easy to read. I'm curious what your secret is to making such a complex game so easy to understand in your writing.
Well, I just be myself, pretty much. I guess I got lucky in that I'm me. But the way I learned poker was through reading books and studying. I was not like naturally gifted at the game. And I mean, when I first started playing, I was just a super nit. Like, I think most people are either really, really tight or really, really loose when they start playing poker. And you have to obviously get much better than that. And the way I learned was by studying and reading and talking to people. And, you know, if you're talking to people and discussing your ideas, ideally you can get them out of your head pretty easily. And I guess I can just get whatever's out of my head onto paper easily enough.
Well, that's so refreshing to hear. I get really tired of the pros who sort of wear it as a badge of honor to say that they've never read a poker book in their life, and that stuff always drives me crazy. Why wouldn't you take advantage of everything that's out there? It just drives me crazy when they say that.
Yeah, I think that if I don't really see how it could possibly hurt to study and read poker books. I mean, I read most books that come out on the market that are, you know, reasonable.
Right.
And I, you know, I don't necessarily learn much from them, but I learn what other people are going to be thinking at the table.
Yeah.
You know, if you hear someone mention a particular poker book at the table and how they say it's their favorite one, you can sort of assume they're going to play kind of like that book suggests. And if you already know what that book says, that guy just told you his complete game plan.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a huge deal.
Let me ask, you know, a lot of times poker coaches do one-on-one things, or they have players pay for private lessons. And how difficult is it to teach different levels of players? I mean, you as a pro, you're so used to thinking on such a high level, but then students may come to you with like a very rudimentary skill of, you know, involved with the game and needing their help. And is there a way that you assess their needs? How does that work out?
The best way to, at least for me, to figure out what level someone's playing on is to see some hands that they play.
Okay.
So usually I'll have people send in a hand history from like an online tournament or something like that, or I'll tell them to write down a few hands that they have questions about before they come to the session. That way we have something to discuss, because I do a lot of private coaching as well.
Right.
That's why I can only do this webinar podcast for a few minutes. Like I have a have a coaching lesson right after this. But yeah, I like to see how people are playing hands and their thought process throughout the hand. And if I review a guy's tournament online and I see maybe like 30 or 40 hands he plays, you can pick up some pretty huge leaks just from a few hands.
Okay.
And so that will help you know what level they're understanding. Like if they miss basic pot ox call situations, or you know they make a call in a terrible spot based on incorrect pot odds, you just know they don't really grasp sort of like the simple math of the game. And that's easy enough to teach. You know, you just pull out a pot odds calculator and whatnot. So once you just see what a guy is doing and you see what they're doing wrong, it's pretty easy to tell them how to fix it.
Well,
I would actually think that the vast majority of poker players out there probably have like just two or three things they do wrong, but those two or three things are detrimental enough to where it makes them not be big winners at the game.
Right, right.
Well, excellent segue into my next question. What's the most common mistake or leak that you see in students?
Well, usually it's they just play too tight and play a little bit too passive. I think that's generally the case. You see a lot of players, particularly like the lower and mid stakes, limping a lot. And I'm actually going to talk about limping in and raise sizing in the intermediate class, because I think that's something that a lot of players can immediately improve on. You'll see a lot of players making it like three big blinds or four big blinds with all of their hands that they plan on playing, but the problem is they're only playing very strong hands, so they just get blinded out unless they get sort of set up and someone has kings when they have aces and they double up. And you don't really want to be waiting around for setup situations in order to hope you get some money. You want to be picking up the pots when everyone has nothing, and I'll discuss how to do that in the intermediate class on the Annie Up Cruise.
Scott, when the show's over, re-listen to that answer again, will you?
Yes, absolutely.
Because you need that help right there.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, we're not surprised that you know, your two-volume Secrets of Poker, a professional tournament poker series, is doing so well. And the question we always get from our listeners and readers is, you know, are these pros really telling us their secrets in these books? How would you answer that?
I think a lot of professionals are not, and I mean, really, a lot of professionals don't really write much of their book. They just sort of put their name on it, but I wrote everything in my book, and I list pretty much my exact game plan on how I play tournament poker. And of course, you have to adjust your strategy based on the players. And I actually just finished Volume 3, which is going to be a bunch of tournament hand histories where I go over like 150 hands, and I'm going to be talking about the adjustments I make from the basic strategy based on my opponents and their ranges and whatnot. So, but yeah, I lay out pretty much everything I know in the book. I talk about my general strategy and game plan in Volume 1. And then Volume 2 is a little bit more about how to adjust based on the level you're at of the tournament, like, you know, if you're near the bubble or at the final table, something like that. And then I also talk about how to live the professional life, you know, how you can manage poker as a profession. And I think that's something that a lot of players really don't do well. You know, a lot of people are really good at actually playing poker, but they're really bad at life. And a lot of people are really good at life, but really bad at poker. And if you can figure it all out and put it together, you'll be well on your way.
Now, we're running an excerpt from Volume 3 in our next issue, our November issue, which is upcoming soon. When is that book coming out? And also, I wanted to know, has it ever come back to bite you on the butt, having books like this out there? Has anybody ever used it against you?
Well, I'm not exactly sure when Volume 3 is coming out. I actually just finished writing it yesterday, so
wow.
That's good.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
it should be Well, I was supposed to turn it in by the end of the year, so that was my deadline. I'm, wow. you know, 2 months ahead of time, so I don't really know when they're going to get it done, but probably early to mid next year.
Okay.
And has it ever bit me in the butt? Possibly. It's kind of surprising the number of people that actually tell me they've read the book as soon as we sit down.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that just kind of negates part of it for them because, you know, I know how to adjust. And, you know, if I know someone's going to play similar to the way I play, I know what to do to beat that. So you just have to, you really just have to figure out a player's range in every situation. And if you can figure that out, poker becomes a pretty easy game. It's the players that play sort of like a kind of unexploitable style that make it tough to play against, but they're not really going to win much money off you, and you're not going to win much money off them. And yeah. so then you're just sort of breaking even, and that's fine because there are eight other people at the table that are going to be ideally losing.
Wow, excellent. All right, well, one of the companies that AnyUp is proud to be associated with is Blue Shark Optics, and you're a pro and endorser for Blue Shark as well. And we rarely see you without your Blue Sharks on. What attracted you to the company?
Well, a long time ago, I was complaining on Twitter about how my sunglasses were no good, and Kathy Liebert suggested Blue Shark Optics to me. So I went out, bought a pair, and I love them. And so I started talking to the owner of the company because I wanted to have some stylish frames, and next thing I know, they offered to make me a Jonathan Little model, and then I have another Jonathan Little model, so two of them. And I love them. I mean, I don't really play poker without them. I find that whenever I wear my contacts, because I'm pretty much blind, probably from typing on the computer and playing online poker. But when I wear my contacts and I don't wear my glasses, I find my eyes are just super dry at the end of the day, probably because I'm more concerned about blinking and managing my blink rate. And, you know, I talk about, like, blink rates and all that stuff in Volume 2 of the book, actually. That's, you know, pretty big tell stuff that people don't really realize. But anyways, I find that my eyes are really dry at the end of the day if I don't wear the glasses. So I'm not going to say they're mandatory for me to wear, but it's just like a comfort thing at this point. I mean, they make it easy for me to sit there all day and feel fresh by the end of the day. And also, you know, it's good to not let people know that you're paying attention. So, you know, quite often I like pull out my phone and play with it in the middle of a hand, but really I'm just like staring down my opponents trying to figure out their tells or figuring out their heart rate and stuff like that. You don't really want people to know you're doing that type of thing.
That cracked me up because you wrote that in a column once before, and that when I read that line, it just cracked me up. I just imagine people trying to play with their phone, but they're not really. They're watching you what you're doing, and that's pretty good. That's a great tip. You know what? Speaking of companies, you're an owner in 3Bet Clothing, which is starting to make a splash in the world of poker clothing. How did you become associated with them, and what can you tell our listeners about the company?
Well, that was another similar situation to Blue Shark Optics where I was, I mean, I'm not, it's tough to find comfortable clothes you can sit in all day and play poker in for whatever reason. I mean, unless you just want to wear like, you know, like a t-shirt or something. And, and you know, I try to look nice at the table. And so I was playing poker one day with a guy and I didn't know who he was. And we talked and we were friendly. And then about a year later, he emailed me talking about this 3Bet clothing brand that he is starting to make with a clothing designer. And so I said, cool. And I looked at some of their stuff and I liked it. And they pretty much brought me on as the owner of the site or owner of the company and asked me to make a team of pros for them. So we ended up getting quite a few pros. We have like Scott Clements, Antonio Sfondiari, Doc Sands, Jason Kuhn, a bunch of other guys. And I think it's a very good clothing line. They're making very nice hoodies, nice shirts that are very comfortable, easy to wear. They're not like ridiculous or anything like that, and I like it. I mean, I wear the stuff all the time.
That's cool.
Well, and you know, whenever I endorse a product, I make sure that I want to wear it like by choice, not necessarily because I'm involved with it. And yeah. I think a lot of people just wear stuff because they're getting paid or something like that. But I mean, you know, I'm an owner of the company, and I like the stuff. If I didn't like the stuff, I wouldn't wear it.
Right.
Well, that's definitely good to hear. You know, well, obviously, we've just listed a bunch of stuff you're involved in, and you just finished a book yesterday. With everything you have going on, how do you find time to play poker and at such a high level, too?
Well, what I do is whenever I'm home, which home for me now is New York City most of the time, it's where my girlfriend lives, I don't really play much poker at all. All I do is focus on, like, the business side of poker. So probably, like, a week and a half out of each month, I'm here, and I just don't play any poker, and I work on the business stuff. And then the other 2.5 weeks, I play poker. And I try to keep them generally separated. Like, you know, I'm going to Las Vegas in 6 hours or something. So for the next week and a half, I'm probably not going to do too much business stuff. I mean, I'll answer emails, but I'm certainly not going to be writing books and making training videos and doing all that type of stuff while I'm out there. So I think if you can somehow separate the things to where whenever you're playing poker, you're playing poker, and whenever you're not playing poker, you're not playing poker, I think that, at least for me, that makes it much easier to keep a balanced life.
Well, the last time we had you on the show, I think I asked you about how important a World Series bracelet was to you, and we talked about you sort of preferred the World Poker Tour, and you always do better there as well. It seems that you've always had much more success with WPT events. Is there something about the WPT that tailored to your game, or what is it that brings out the best in you?
Well, I think the WPT tailors to pretty much all good professionals' games, because you're usually very deep stacked throughout the entire event.
Okay.
And I talked about this in Volume 3. I was writing the introduction yesterday, because some of the hands are from the $25,000 World Poker Tour event, and some of the hands are from a $1,000 World Series event. And I discussed how in the World Series event, you pretty much have to get all in a few times if you're going to make it deep in the tournament. And whenever you get all in, you are going to lose sometimes.
Yeah.
And in World Poker Tour events, the ones that I usually do well in, I find that I really just don't get all in until the last hand where I bust. And
yeah.
And even then, it's still probably like a 50 big blind deep hand or something. So even then, some of those are marginally avoidable. So World Poker Tour events basically let you sit around, grind up a stack without ever risking going broke. Whereas in a lot of World Series of Poker events, you have to risk going broke. It's a little bit different when you start playing the larger buy-in ones, like the $5,000 and $10,000 buy-in ones at the World Series, because those are a bit deeper stacked. But even then, they're not nearly as deep stacked as World Poker Tour events.
Right.
Wow, interesting. All right, well, we're starting the Ania Poker Tour next month, and there are obviously plenty of other tournament series out there. With so many event options these days, what goes into your decision on where to travel?
Well, the main consideration is how much I expect to win on the trip and return on investments. So, I actually had this dilemma a year ago. There was the World Series of Poker Europe, where I knew I could go and invest like $100,000, which is a pretty good amount. Or I could stay in America and go to Biloxi and then Foxwoods, and I could invest like $50,000. And to go to Biloxi and Foxwoods, it would have cost me like $1,000 total or something like that. But to go to Europe, it would have cost like $5,000 total. And they rake significantly more in Europe as well. And they have like a 4% non-refundable tax. So all that combined made it like a pretty easy decision just to stay in America. So basically what the main factors are is pretty much how much it costs to get there and how much I expect to win in the tournament. So if the tournament's, say, $5,000, I expect to win maybe, say, $3,000 in the tournament, let's just say. And it costs, $2,000 to get to the place, and I have to be there for a week, it's definitely not worth it for me to go sit somewhere for a week to win $2,000.
Yeah.
At least in my brain.
Right.
But and for that reason, I usually tend to go to places that have a series of events. So like Vegas here, I'm going today. There's two $5,000 events, a $2,500 event, and a $10,000 event, all within a 8-day time span. So that's pretty good. And also, it's relatively cheap for me to go to Vegas because I have a house there already. So that's like a just like an easy, you have to go to it. There's some tournaments at the Hard Rock in Florida, actually, that I tend to not go to. They usually have they're smaller events, maybe like $2,500 events and $1,000 events. The thing is, they don't give you a poker rate for the room, so you have to pay like $250 for a room unless you want to rent a house and drive a car. So the next thing I know, I'm paying like $2,500 to stay at the hotel to only risk $2,500 in tournaments. So it's like a guaranteed losing proposition. So if you're like a local player and you can drive to places and you can play tournaments easily, you should definitely go to any event that's near you. But if you have to pay a lot of money to get to an event, you probably shouldn't go to it.
I got like a two-part question here. Is there a minimum buy-in that you look for in these series when you play? In other words, does the main event have to be at least $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that? Is that something that you won't even consider unless it's that much? And then the other question is, when you're considering these events, how much time do you need? Do you ever just go, like, we have our Ania Poker Tour coming up in November, so it's like a month and a half away. Is that enough time for you to plan, or is that something like, you've already set your schedule?
I generally try to set my schedule for events as soon as they put out the schedule.
Okay.
So, for example, Bellagio has not put up their tournament for December yet. They have a tournament in December. The main event is going to be December 5th or something like that. But they haven't put up the preliminary event, so I haven't booked anything yet, and that's fine. It's just mildly annoying. But I try to book as far ahead as I can. But, you know, I guess I generally have a schedule of events I play most of the time. And I just try to play most of the biggest buy-in events. And what was the other question?
The amount of the main event. Does it have to be a certain amount?
Well, no. It just depends on your return on investment and how much money you have to pay to get there. Okay. You know, like if there was a $500 tournament down the street every day, I'd go play that every day. Because I could walk there for free and play it. But if I have to pay $1,000 to go play like I said, $1,000, say I have to pay $2,000 to go play a $5,000 event, I just won't go. Because it's not worth it.
Okay.
And that's just it's a matter of making money. You know, it's a poker is a business, and you need to play the events that make the most sense.
So the time leading up to it doesn't really matter. If something's attractive to you, you'll still make time for it as long as it makes sense money wise.
Yeah. Actually, in London, I was in Paris or in Cannes about to play World Series of Poker Europe event. The next day was a 3,000 euro shootout, and I get this phone call, and someone wants to put me in a 100,000 pound event in London the next day, and I'd have to leave on a flight in like 6 hours. So I'd already had a little bit of wine. I wasn't like, yeah, well, whatever. I'll get on my flight at 7 a.m. tomorrow and go play a 100,000 pound event. And so, you know, that was like a 7 hour notice to go play a giant tournament, but whatever. So yeah, you don't really have to have too much notice as long as the flights are reasonable and the travel is minimal.
Okay.
I'm fascinated by the calculations you make, and it doesn't surprise me just knowing how tedious or focused you are on things. But when you factor in, do you factor in expected field size too? I mean, it's not just a $10,000 event or a $5,000 event. It's whether there's going to be 200 people, 500 people, or something like that, or is that not a calculation that matters?
Well, the field size is only relevant in that it affects your return on investment, because the more people in the field, the higher return on investment you can expect to have in general. So, for example, these Bellagio tournaments I'm going to are going to have a pretty small field. Like, the main event might get 100 people. Maybe. I'd be shocked if it got 100 people. But however, if, you know, 25% of the people are pretty bad, then that means there's, you know, $250,000 worth of dead money in there being split up by 75 guys. So you 250K divided by 75, and that's probably about how much you're going to win, assuming those guys are actually absolute dead, which they're not. So, you know, it's probably more like, you know, 200K or something divided by 75 guys. And even then, you know, some of the guys in the middle of the field are probably going to be losing to players like myself. And you have to figure out your return on investment pretty much. And so, like, say you play a $500 event with the same exact field, you're going to have the same exact return on investment. It doesn't really matter the size of the buy-in. What matters is the players and how they play. But say instead you have a 500-person field and 75 players are good and 425 are no good, your return on investment is going to be significantly higher.
Right.
And that's why a lot of pros will come out why pretty much everyone comes out for the World Series of Poker main event, because there's maybe like, you know, 500 people that are good and then the rest are just not very good.
Right, yeah.
Well, what are some of the upcoming events that are on your schedule then?
I'm going to Bellagio today, and then I'm going to go to Jacksonville. I actually don't even know what I'm doing. I keep my schedule written in my iPad so I don't forget it. I'm pretty bad with this stuff. I'm going to Jacksonville. I know that's in November. I'm actually going to run the New York City Marathon in...
Wow.
Like 3 weeks, so I'm kind of dreading that. The longest I've ever run is 20 miles, and I don't think it's going to get any further before the 26th.
Well, if you're dreading it, why are you doing it?
Well, because I'm not going to have the opportunity later, because I'm only going to get in worse shape, I think. let's see. After Jacksonville is Borgata. Borgata is a good example of a place where I can go really cheaply, because if I'm in New York City, I can just get a car or take a train there, and it costs like $30 or something.
Yeah.
And they generally give me pretty good hotel rates. So that's a good example of somewhere where I would definitely not go if I was in, say, Las Vegas and had to pay $2,000 to get there. But if I'm sitting in New York City, I'll definitely go to Borgata. So that's a really good example of one that I would go not go to normally, but I would go to because of it. And then Bellagio at the end of the year, and then that's going to round out that year. And then the start of next year is the PCA, and then right after that is the Antiup Cruise, and that is all I have planned.
Awesome.
Excellent. Well, hey, Jonathan, we appreciate very much taking the time out of your busy schedule. Good luck with the webinar here soon, and we'll definitely look forward to seeing you on February 4th.
Awesome. I hope everyone comes out and hope they all invite their friends. I'm going to be giving away lots of free stuff, and I'll have my books for sale on the boat. Maybe I'll give some of those away. I don't know. You know, I want to make it a good experience for everyone. So if anyone has any suggestions, definitely let us know, and I'll be more than happy to accommodate.
Excellent. Thanks, man. Appreciate your time today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right. Talk to you later.
Thanks. Good luck, Jonathan.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, folks, we are to the bottom of the barrel on Hands of the Week.
Yeah,
we take no pride in begging, but I will beg. send us your week, your feeble. Send us your Hands of the Week, your situations, anything. Not only are we at the bottom of the barrel, we're actually scraping that crud off the bottom here.
Well, I'm sure that makes our contributor this week feel great.
That was our friend Ken, and he actually sent these hands to us probably 2 years ago.
Oh my god!
And they've been holding on, and he essentially said that he's like, "Yo, here's a bunch of hands. You know, I know you're not going to use them, but if you get desperate, well, October 26, 2012, we've become desperate."
You know what's funny is I'm pretty sure that we have 7 years of this. If you went back to like year two and grabbed those hands and used them, just change the name, no one would ever know. So we may have to resort to doing that. So just send us some hands, please, because I don't want to have to reuse hands. Oh, man. It's not that you couldn't learn from those. It's not. I mean, we should call them classic hands. And
that's true. That's
we redo them and see how we would play them differently, you know?
Yeah, but we obviously would prefer to do new stuff, right?
Really. Oh, yeah, no, I know. But what about that? There's some interest in that. You record the hand, and then you say, oh, Chris, well, in 2009, you said that you were going to fold this hand, but today you've called. Well, you know, I mean, there's some interest in that, I guess. But,
yeah, that's true.
But we do want fresh hands, so please send them in.
It shows you how much of a worse player we've become.
That's right, and it's true. You can't become a worse poker player.
All right, well, anyhow, we appreciate that Ken went to Las Vegas back when the mob was still running it and played this tournament at the Venetian, which he says was one of those $150 buy-ins, which what he describes as a ridiculously good structure, 8,000 chips, 30-minute levels, slow blind structure. I think lots of people agree that Venetian has, you know, some of the best structured tournaments out there. He says the only thing he doesn't like is that it's 10-handed tables.
Hmm. What I find interesting is that this hand came from when the Venetian's poker room just opened, and now they've just reopened their new room called the Sands Poker Room. So that's how long it's been since we got this hand. Of course, I'm joking, but all right. So let's go. Let's get right into it.
All right. So So he's been playing a little bit here. He's up to about 9K in chips now. So he's squeezed out an extra 1,000 here so far. Three limps, and we look down at jack of clubs, jack of spades in the small blind.
Okay, what were the blinds again?
Does not say. So there's probably a reason I didn't get this on the show before. But you can raise we can give our answers in the big blinds, right?
Oh man, it's so hard to do a hand of the week when you don't know what the blinds are.
It's only going to get harder, sir. This is why we need folks to send us hands.
Okay, so here's my answer then. I'm shoving. No, I don't have to worry about it.
No, we're fairly early in this. I would say, let's see. Well, he gave the structure here. We started at 2550. We're no worse than the 5100 level at this point. Probably it could still be in the 2550.
All right. Well, then I'm going to raise way more than 3x because...
Oh, actually, we're on the first level. I'm sorry. So it is 2550.
Okay. So even so...
Now, Ken's never going to send us a bunch of old hands now. We can't get...
With three limpers, you know, and you got jack-jack, you're so susceptible to any hand, really. You're going to want to make it a pretty big raise here. And you're in a small blind, so you're out of position. no matter who comes into the hand with you. So you got to be thinking like that. You got to be thinking, okay, my hand's vulnerable, but it's a good hand. And I have limpers already in this pot, and I have still the big blind behind me too. So if you're going to make it 3x, that'd be 150. You got three limpers, so that'd make it 200, 250, 300, you know, 300 or so. So I have no problem making it 350, 400 to go.
Okay. Here's an interesting discussion, I think, because this came up in a tournament I played last week, and I know our fans are upset that I went and proofed the pages and came back with almost no stories. But it was first or second level, and I made it 3x, you know, standard raise, right?
Uh-huh.
And ended up losing the hand to some guy that called me with King Trey or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the big blind. And he's like, oh, it's only 150. Well, I'm supposed to fold it for that? And I think that's an interesting point. I mean, if you're starting in that tournament, I think we started with 10,000 in chips, and it's 25 to 50, you make it 150. Obviously, from a, you know, a structure there, that seems to be enough, the proper bet, right?
Mm.
But when people are sitting, everybody at the table sitting with 10,000, I can see how some people say, it's only 150, why not take a flyer here?
Yeah. Yeah, that's how they lose all their money. But yeah, I know.
Exactly. So, I mean, does that force you to stick with your 150, knowing that people are going to call with crap and probably beat you with it early? And obviously, you're not going to lose a lot early.
Right.
Or does it force you to make what seems to you rather ridiculously bigger bets so they at least get some respect? Particularly when we're talking about a hand like Jack-Jack, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have the answer to that. I mean, it's... It's funny because when I play poker, I look at my hand and I think to myself, can I get into trouble with this hand? It's the first thing I think of. And I'm like, if I can get in trouble with this hand, why get in trouble with this hand? And
exactly.
I think of Lee Child saying, make easy decisions, make things easier on yourself when you're playing, and I let it go. So I can't think like everyone else too. You know what I mean? It's tough. So I have to, in your case, you found out pretty quickly how this guy played, so now you could adjust, but
very true. Very
you know,
true.
But the rest of the table might be a 3x type of folding play table, and he's the 8x type of folding guy, and that's why poker is so difficult, especially at our level when we're playing $100 buy-ins instead of
right.
You know, $500 to $1,500 buy-ins, and you know you're getting some kind of quality play there.
Okay, so to take it back to this hand, then this is what I'm wondering is this is the very first level. He doesn't mention this, but I got to think we have very little read on any of our opponents, right?
Mm.
And so to put in a significant raise here, and significant the limits, not so much the starting stack, with an extremely vulnerable hand in the worst position, are we setting ourselves up to make a bad decision, or potentially make a bad decision? And should that factor into our minds?
But based on how much we're raising, or...
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, I mean, is there a case to be made for just limping along here and set mining with jacks, which you wouldn't normally do later on in the tournament when you have a better feel for the table and the limits are big different. And but right now, for me, and again, I'm Mr. Conservative here, I'm not really willing to start getting into a war here with players. I have no idea how they play when I'm out of position with this hand where... Generally, I mean, the rule of jacks usually is all in or fold, which is, you know, hilarious. But that's what people say because it becomes hard to play. You know, queen, king, ace comes on the board. What do you do then? And if it's below that, then you run into straights and stuff like that. I think it's a very difficult hand to play. So I'm not saying that I would definitely limp here. But and if I'm going to raise, I'm going to raise it to the limit that you mentioned. But I wonder while we're feeling at the table here, you know, why not just complete our small blind to big blind and disguise our hand and maybe play a little bit differently with it?
Hmm. Nah. Well, here's the deal.
Scott.
I don't think we learn anything by limping here. I don't think we gain any kind of edge. And how are you going to play this hand with four other limpers in this hand with you, no matter what comes on the flop? You're letting people limp with anything. Now, what you have no way of narrowing their range, even if they are people you don't know.
I'm set mining. To me, it's these jacks right now, in my opinion, are no different than deuces.
So you're telling me if it came 2-7-9 rainbow and the and you were first to act, you would check?
Yes, I would.
You would check. And then if someone bet, you would fold.
Because at that point, I'm trapping. Now, obviously, if the hand gets out of control, I don't want to do that. But I don't want to... I mean, the problem here is if we raise now, we generally are going to have to put a c-bet in regardless, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what if it's a king, queen, or ace? Or what if it's some other kind of trouble thing? At that point, we're out of position, and now we're going to be forced to be firing three bullets at this thing. And we already were popping it to 300 or 400 hours, right? So if everybody calls, which is probably likely, because everybody's deep stacked right now, you're going to have, what, 16, somewhere between 15 and 2,000 in the pot. So your next bet is going to be, what, 750? You get a couple callers. I mean, eventually, this is going to turn into an expensive hand. I mean, right now, we don't care. We got 9,000, and we're popping it to 300 or 400, right? But the problem is, being out of position, this hand is going to escalate to the point where we're going to be making a $2,000 or $3,000 bet at some point. And maybe not, and most likely without a jack on the board.
Mm.
That's what I'm worried about. I mean, I'm only bringing this up because you mentioned, you know, hey, I'm trying not to make... I don't want to be in a situation where I'm making hard decisions.
Right.
And I think this is a situation where right now it doesn't seem like a hard decision, but two more streets, we could find ourselves in a dark alley.
Well, the thing about jacks is that you have to take advantage of the hands when you get them, and it's not a bad hand. It's a good hand.
Oh, I know. I absolutely agree.
So I can't play it passively. I just can't play it passively. I'm going to have to... If I just sit there, and like you said before, so you would check on that board. So let's say you checked... And you said you were hoping to check raise? Is that what you were saying? Because if you're going to check raise, then to me, it's sort of contradictory what you're saying then. I mean, if you're going to play it aggressively after a flop where you don't know what anybody has, why not play it aggressively after flop when you've narrowed their range of average poker players would be playing after you made it 400 pre-flop? I just think that you're making it more difficult for yourself by limping and then trying to check raise.
Well, but you're assuming that I'm going to continue to think that my jacks are a strong hand after the flop. What I'm doing is I'm neutering this hand right now.
Yeah, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to do that to you?
Again, it's the first level. I don't know how people plan. I'm out of position. Now, like I said, give me two more levels of playing against these players, and I'm going to play this in the same situation, probably very differently.
Hmm. Well, I mean, there's something to be said for being crafty with the hand, but I feel like, you know, you've let guys see a free flop, you know, and even if you check raised, you're telling them your hand was so strong that you could have afforded to give them the turn for free, essentially, is what you're saying. And jacks aren't that strong, even on that flop. I don't know. Oh, well, I would have raised. So that's, I don't want to drag this hand on too long, but I would have raised pre-flop. Easily. All right. I would have wanted to narrow it down. I'm out of position the rest of the hand. You know, I want to be against one guy, and I'm going to continuation bet no matter what comes on the board because he doesn't know it. If it's that early in the tournament, he doesn't know what I'm raising with either. So he could think I have ace-king if it comes ace-jack-3 or ace-10-3. You know, well, he thinks I have ace-king, and now I'm ahead, and he was just calling along hoping to bust me with pocket fives. You know, I don't know. I would raise. I would play this pretty straightforward, I think.
All right, well, Hero does pop it to 300. A little bit less than you said, but within range, right?
Yeah.
He says, a big blind who is an aggressive, bleary-eyed Eastern European guy with squiggly 6K. Again, we're not typecasting at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
Min raises to 600.
Mm.
Folds around back to us. Now what do we do?
Well, I find it interesting that it's so early on in the tournament, yet he's got this guy pretty much pegged already, you know.
That's only the first level too, yeah. So,
well, now I got no problem calling. You know, if it comes all unders, then we'll be interesting to see what we do. But I mean, I have no problem calling now and seeing a flop with jacks, thinking that he, you know, could be min raising with anything here. He could have kings, he could have ace king, he could have nines. You know, who knows? He could have connectors. You know, who knows? So I don't mind calling here. I'm not gonna four bet him.
All right. Well, that's an interesting discussion, I think, to have, right? Because here's the thing. I'm not saying that I wouldn't do this either, but I'm going from extremely passive in this hand to extremely aggressive. So I'm on the outer edges of Cosenza.
Yeah.
In this entire hand. I mean, here's the thing. If this guy's aggressive, he's in the big blind. The min raise is kind of weird. I'll give you that. But an aggressive player, I mean, you're right, you could be playing with anything. So I've got a legitimate hand here. And I know I just said I was going to neuter it, but that's we didn't neuter it. We played it strong. You know, I might want to put into a test here and, you know, pop this again and really see what he has.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that either.
Now we're getting really committed to the hand, which goes back to the whole reason I probably didn't want to race in the first place. But at that time, I didn't know I had an aggressive, bleary-eyed Eastern European guy in the big blind. So now we have more information.
Well, the other thing, too, is it depends on your style of play. Are you playing for small ball and pot control, or are you trying to get it all in and triple up before you're even out of level one?
Exactly. That's a good point. And I guess my... Here's the thing. I think aggressive players are the hardest players to play against. For me, personally. Right. I just don't know how to play them. And that they're effective against me. Because here's the thing. I mean, if I just call here, I feel like I'm turning this control this hand over to him. And now I'm really hoping that it's all unders or a jack, and then I can feel more confident. If it's going to be anything else, then I'm going to be in hand-to-hand combat with this guy that can play anything the rest of the hand, and that could get really expensive. If I raise here now, obviously I'm thinking that I'm going to let him know, hey, you know what? I've actually got something here, so you're going to have to really outplay me, and then that gives me some more options. But he very well could 5-bet me or try to take it away from me on the flop, regardless of what comes.
Well, so if this guy is as aggressive as it's being painted, and if you made it 1,800 and then he shoves, are you going to call with jacks? If you're going to lay it down, then why are you raising him anyway? If you know he's aggressive, he might re-raise you again. Right. I don't think it's going to... If he's just aggressive and he's got position on you, he may not go anywhere anyway. So why not just call and see a flop and then, you know...
Okay, that's fine. But I guess my point is, if you just call here, are you, in your mind, turning over control of the hand to him? Or are you still, in your mind, very much in control of this hand?
I feel like I'm in control only because I'm trying to control the size of the pot. I don't want it to get so bloated that I have to risk my stack with a queen high flop out there or a king high flop. Whereas if I re-raise and then he just calls and then it comes king or queen. If you made it 18, he called, there's 36 in the pot plus the other limps. You're looking at like $4,000 in the pot about. What kind of bet is he going to make that I can't fold? You know, I'll have, you know, I have like, what, 7,000 left? If he makes a 3,000 bet, you know, it's 50% of my stack almost. So it's tough. I really like the pot control early on in these tournaments. I hate it the way, you know, you're playing 25-50, you got $10,000 in front of you, and you're like, oh my God, I just played a 7,000-unit pot at 25-50, and it happens all the time. So, but I do like your idea of re-raising. If the guy truly is incredibly aggressive and he's just trying to be a jerk, not a jerk, but I mean he's trying to do his game thing, and there's no way he has better than jacks there, maybe I do pop it again. Maybe I just shove on him. I don't know. But it's so early in the tournament, we've shown that we can win a couple of pots, clearly, because we're already up 1,000 on the first level. You know, do I want to just get it all in with this guy when I'm showing that I'm a better player than them, at least in the early stages of this tournament? So, I don't know. I don't mind the call. The reason why I don't mind the call is because we are heads up now, and I can really get a better read on what this guy is doing or what I think he has. If I limped, I would have been five-handed if the guy didn't raise. You know what I mean? I don't know what he would have done if I hadn't raised, so... I don't know. It is an interesting discussion. I think you could go right by raising again here, and I think you can go right by calling. I don't really think either one's wrong, depending on what type of player you are.
Right. Okay. So let's say if you call, what are you going to do with a queen, king, or ace on the flop?
Well, I'm probably going to check and see how much he bets. And then
see how much he bets. Okay.
And if I don't believe him, if I just feel like it's this random, quick, automatic bet that he puts out there, I'm gonna think about check raising him. And then if it's something where I feel like he's serious, and I may still call depending on the amount, and then if I check the turn he checks, now on the river I'll wake up and blow him out of the water. So it just depends on that flop what I'm gonna do. But I probably would check if it had maybe just a queen high. I might not. I might bet, but again I might check raise him. Because if he's that aggressive, I might check raise him and he'll fold his nines, you know what I mean, or whatever it is he has. So,
right.
I might check raise.
Okay. All right, well, our hero does make the call. So the pot's 1,300, and the flop comes 9 of hearts, tray of spades, deuce of clubs.
Yeah, I'm going to check raise this guy. If he's aggressive, I'm going to check raise him and then see what happens after that. If he goes crazy on me after that, then I'll let the hand go, you know. But it's still just one bet. Instead of me raising him preflop to 1800, now I've made that bet here, and I've gotten more information, so I think I'll check raise him.
All right, well, Hero does check, and our opponent bets, in his words, a very small 400.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely raising him now. I would probably make it like 1200 or 1300. Because right, I would have made it 1800 preflop if I followed the aggressive line. So it's almost the same bet anyway. Now I've got all unders to my pair, and there are a lot of hands that I beat that would have min-raised me. So,
right. All right, well, the pot's 1700, and our hero raises to 1500 total. Okay. 1100 on top.
Yeah.
Our opponent thinks for a few seconds and ships it. It's about 4K for us to call into a pot of 8K. If we, we're down to 3K if we call and lose. And obviously, we're up to 14, 15 or so.
I call. Right. I call.
See, I guess this is what I was talking about at the beginning. I got a call here. You know, if he's got kings, queens, aces, or I guess nines at this point, you know, good hand. But we got ourselves committed. And I'm not saying we would have got committed had we... I mean, obviously, when we got that re-raise before, but if we had just checked pre-flop, I don't know what he would have bet then. And of course, endless flop is great for our hand, so we might have ended up in the same situation, but it may not have gotten to this point at this point. We might have got to this point after the turn when we had one more card to see, which... not a great deal, but it's better than not seeing it, right?
Yeah.
You know, if that turn's a jack, then this is a easy decision. But we don't know what that turn is right now.
Yeah, you're looking at... even if we just call the big blind preflop and then he makes it... See, that's the other thing. You don't know what he would make it then. And if he only min-raised then, he might get all those other guys in the hand with us. So there's just no way to figure it out. And he might not
raise. That's the thing with an aggressive player.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think the advantage of being an aggressive player is that you're not really trying to pick up these raise and take-its with the blinds. You're waiting for somebody else to put some money in the pot and then raise them again, knowing that you're putting pressure on them, and now you've got a bigger thing to win without a showdown.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious. I mean, obviously, we'll never know. But if we just called a small blind, he might have just, you know, checked and then tried to outplay a bunch of people or shut down his hand or whatever else if he didn't have anything. I mean, obviously, if he has a real hand, then he's still going to bet. But I don't think he was trying to take our money here by our min raise. I really don't know what to think of that min raise preflop, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's at this point, I don't know if you can fold. I mean, I guess you could. You'd have 3,000 chips, and the blinds really are 2,550.
2,550, you got plenty of
play.
You're going to be off your game, I think, unless you're a really good player.
Yeah.
You're going to really think that you just lost $5,000 for no reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to call, especially because the guy's real aggressive, and he could have anything. He could have ace-nine. So he could have tens. He could have ace-nine. He could have eights. You know, he could have ace-king and just think that his hand is good and that we're just making a move. There are a lot of hands there that could still make that move from an aggressive player and not have us beat. And there's so much money out there now. I don't want to have 3,000.
The other thing is we're actually, and that's if we call and lose. I mean, right now we could fold this right now and we've only put 2,100 in this.
Right.
Of our, 8K to start with. So we have 6K if we fold.
But if we call and lose, we still have 3,000 left.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's the difference between 3K and 6K, and I think at that point, you got to put it in here. Right?
Yeah, I can't fold.
There's no real difference this early in the tournament between 3K and 6K.
It's going to suck to have 3K left if we lose, but we're still got plenty of time. We have good structures at this tournament, and we have plenty of chips. So, you know, you have to battle back and maybe double through somebody, maybe this same guy again later, who knows, to get back to where you were.
Well, I mean, even at 3K, you've got plenty of play. I mean, you may not be in this situation again.
Yeah.
And you can get right back up to 8K just playing your normal game.
Yeah.
To me, though, I mean, it's... again, there's no difference between 3K and 6K. If this board had an ace, king, or queen, that that made it a little more difficult, then that's one thing. But right now, we've got an overpair to the board. So really, there's only one, two, three, six hands that beat us right now, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess if you count nine trade, two pair, some kind of weird two pair combination, but that seems unlikely. And at this point, I'm willing to take that 3K gamble. I mean, it'd be different if this was a for my stack and I'm out of the tournament decision. That's a little different, but you know, I certainly don't want to lose 5K in this hand. But at this point, I'm willing to risk that last 3,000 to bump up to 14 or 15.
15, yeah, at least 15. So, yeah. All right. Well, I'm assuming he calls, because if he folded, we wouldn't have a hand of the week, right? I think he would call.
All right, well, he went through the calculations, he grimaces, shakes his head, rolls his eyes, and mucks.
Oh, no, no. Yeah. Are you serious?
Our aggressive, blurry eye, Eastern European, does not show us what he got.
Oh, all right, well, let's just assume he has queens, so he made a good fold.
So it made us feel better.
Oh, man.
But I think that last part of the hand turned out to be the most fascinating to me, because this is what I'm seeing. I mean, this is what, a $150 tournament at the Venetian with a better structure. That's a little different. But, you know, I'm playing these, and I think most of our listeners play these $60 to $100 daily tournaments at their local card room.
Right.
Where the structures are not terrific. Sometimes they're good, but they're never terrific. And, I mean, I think these are the kind of decisions that we run into a lot that I think are different in those type of tournaments than in a really deep stack, good structured tournament. Where it comes down to just making some mathematical calculations there. I mean, and what we talked about at the end is no real difference between 3K and 6K left in our stack when it's 25-50. So now at that point, it's not even figuring out what our opponent has. It's just making that calculation that, you know, it's not that big of a difference, and I've got a decent shot of winning this hand, so let's get it in, and either I'm going to have 3K or 15K, and either way, I'm still competitive in this tournament.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a bad fold, no. I'm not saying that he played it properly or didn't play it properly up until that point, but I really think you need to make that call there, given what you'd have left and how early it is in the tournament, and the reward of being right there. Plus, you don't know what would come on the turn on the river. You know, you never know. You could have made it a third jack, too. So there's always that intangible that you can't rely on, but it is there. You know, it's like a half an hour or something, so.
Yep.
Hmm. Oh, well.
All right, Ken. Well, we appreciate you sending this hand in 17 years ago, and hope you're still alive and stuff. If so, we're going to send you a deck of J-Design playing cards, probably a vintage deck.
Yeah.
The official playing cards of Ante Up. Everybody else, pick up your own decks in the Ante Up store at anteupstore.com, and please send us hands of the week.
Yeah, really, it's
we get a lot of mileage out of a hand that didn't even get to the turn there.
That's an old hand of the week right there we just used, so please help us out. Alright, I want to thank Jonathan Little for not only agreeing to be on a cruise with us, but also for being on our show today. Always cool to have him on. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
I was telling Chris, I thought it was hilarious. You're emailing me like at 11:45 after I signed off, and I signed back on like at 7:15, and there's another email from you at 7. So I'm guessing you don't sleep ever, do you?
No, not really.
I mean, obviously, we've had 100 emails back and forth, but we haven't really talked. Is there anything that's easier to talk about now that we're talking here before we start the show about the February cruise? Any questions you have?
No, I think I'm pretty good.
Okay.
Excellent. All right, cool.
After 100 emails, you pretty much
Excellent.